Okay, so let's continue. We are going to start the next, there are two slides pending from last time. We will start the next chapter, which is going to be on file system. So before we do that, we will do our Thursday parable. This one is on the economist, the statistician and the mathematician. There is no computer scientist here, but you can guess who is the computer scientist. Okay, so the story goes that the three of them are on a train and in a new country, and they see a black cow in a field. And the economist says, look, a black cow. So all cows in this country are black. And then the statistician says, not so fast, that's incorrect. All you can say is there is a field in this country where there is at least one cow that is black. And then the mathematician says, that is not at all true. All you can say is there's at least one field in this country where there's at least one cow which is black on the left side. What that says is you should be careful of your assumptions. I had a parable where the moral was pick your project partners carefully, but I thought that may be a bit too late for that too, so I gave up on it. Okay, so we will continue our discussion. There are two slides from last class actually. So we were talking about memory management, specifically page replacement algorithms. We did random FIFO, min, LRU. Last time I showed you something called Ballady's anomaly, which said as you add memory to processes, there are certain page replacement algorithms that behave worse. Okay, kind of completely counterintuitive. Clearly you don't want to use such algorithms in operating systems. I said LRU actually does not have Ballady's anomaly. And then we spent much of the class talking about approximations to LRU. Okay, because LRU is expensive to implement. And towards the end of the class I was talking about multi-programming and thrashing. Okay, thrashing is a scenario where memory is overcommitted and the process is continuously page faulting. Okay, the right way to get around thrashing is to look at the working set of the process. A working set is the set of pages the process is currently working on, and ensure that you give it at least that much memory. Okay? And so if you have at least as many page frames as your working set, you are going to not page fault as frequently and your performance will be good. Okay, so that is basically where we left it off, and then here's some couple of more things here to discuss. One is page sizes. Okay, so I did mention this some time back, and I just wanted to bring this back. We have assumed that page sizes are in the 1 to 4K range. Obviously, there is nothing that prevents an OS from choosing whatever page size it wants for its memory management. Okay, so just to understand the trade-offs, if you choose a small page size, okay, you will get more effective memory use because you will have less internal fragmentation, better use of your memory overall. Larger degree of multi-programming may be possible because there are more pages to go around. Same amount of RAM but more pages, and presumably you can then have more processes to share those pages. Okay? And the other end of the spectrum, if you have very large page sizes, you get small page tables. Yeah, because there are only that many pages to go around, so the page table will shrink. Okay, you will have better amortization of your page fault overheads over the execution, because every time you page fault, you read a larger chunk of memory, and then that page is also bigger, so you will have fewer page faults. Okay, so you are going to amortize your page fault overhead over larger page. You might have fewer page faults because there are fewer pages to go around. Okay? So those are the trade-offs between large and small. And the thing to keep in mind is because physical RAM is increasing in size, right, and also because CPU speeds are also increasing fast, and specifically they are increasing faster than disk speeds, overall page sizes have been growing. Okay? So it's not uncommon to now see 8K pages, right, which is a doubling of the page size. And that's because you have more RAM, so then you can increase the page size and not have to have much larger page tables and so on. And as the CPU speed increases, the cost of the relative cost of a page fault goes up, because you have more instructions executing in a shorter amount of time, and then a large page fault where you take a you suspend the process. So having bigger pages helps in that case. Okay, so these are trade-offs to keep in mind as far as choosing the right page size is concerned. Okay. One, the very last slide on memory management is on kernel memory allocator. Okay. Thus far, everything we have talked about has been from the perspective allocating memory to user processes. Okay. So now the kernel also needs to do its own memory management. Yeah, the kernel is a process, and in this case it has to manage its own memory. Okay. Now, just as if you write a C program, you can do a malloc and dynamically allocate memory, so can the kernel. Yeah, the size of the kernel will grow and shrink. For instance, as you have more processes, the number of PCB entries is going to grow. The PCB is, list is not pre-allocated. Yeah, because as you, it dynamically grows as you start up new processes. Okay, so how does it grow? You have to allocate more memory. Okay, so most kernels will actually have a kernel implementation of malloc. Okay, if you are writing a kernel, you can't call malloc. Okay, because malloc is a C library function. The kernel doesn't know what malloc is. So you actually, in Linux for instance, you will have kmalloc, which is the kernel's implementation of malloc for itself. Yes, question.
I just had a question. When the kernel is reading in a program to turn into a process, and for instance in a Java program, does it read in all the news and allocate that when it creates a process, or are those the same as malloc where they're allocated afterwards?
What is allocated? The heap?
Like create a new object in a method in Java.
Right.
Is that read in at the start or after?
Okay, so there are probably two aspects to your question. There is in a process, there is the code segment, right? There is a stack, and there is the heap. Okay, heap and stack grow towards one another. So, as far as the code is concerned, whatever code you have written will be read in, and if you are doing demand paging, it will be read in on demand. Okay, so whether it's to allocate a new stack or not. So what happens is you allocate this address space for the stack and the heap segments, but you are not actually assigned page frame. So some of this memory is empty. In the sense that there is a space here, but it's not allocated to anything. As you actually do malloc, and let's say the size of the heap grows, this is when actually a new page is allocated to the process. Okay, so some part, so this is how the process grows and shrinks at all. So address space is fixed, this is the max size of the address space. But then parts of it may be empty, that's a big hole in there, it's not allocated to anything, it's empty space. And then the stack and the heap will grow and shrink. Okay, so that's how, is that what you were asking?
Yeah, more or less.
Okay. Okay, so now as far as the kernel goes, the kernel, as I said, doesn't have the luxury of calling C library function. It has to implement everything itself. Libraries are written for users, okay, not for kernel. So kernel has to implement its own memory allocators. Here are just two that are examples of what. There's a simple one called buddy allocator, which allocates memory in sizes of 2 to the power n. Okay. And so that basically the reason, so even though you may want to allocate a PCB of size, let's say 58 bytes, it is going to allocate memory in chunks of 2 to the power n. So it's going to round it up to the next 2 to the power n and allocate. The reason for this is you don't want internal fragmentation inside the kernel. Yeah, the kernel is paged, but the heap is actually going to grow and shrink, the kernel heap. So you want to ensure that you can do this in a reasonable way, which is why you put some restriction. Okay, if you are doing user level malloc, you can ask for an object of size X and you will get an object of size X. In kernels, you don't have that luxury. Okay, so you want to reduce some of it. The other one is called a slab allocator. So here, what you do is, and malloc, the implementations of malloc also use slab allocation. Okay. So what happens in a slab allocator is you actually allocate memory in larger size chunks, but then you use those chunks and partition the objects in those chunks. So if you want, let's say, so if you want to allocate a struct, you can allocate an entire page dynamically. So that's the simplest thing to do. And then chop that page up and say, this is assigned to object O. And the next time you do a malloc, you are not going to allocate a new piece of memory. You will take this unused piece and say, I'm just going to allocate some part of that. So here is object K. and so on and so forth. So what the memory allocator will do is it will allocate a larger chunk, let's say a page at a time or some number of pages at a time, and then chop those up into individual objects and hand them out. Okay? This simplifies how you do memory allocation. It also eliminates the need to allocate arbitrary size chunks, because you are allocating, logically you are allocating pages, but then you chop that up into object sizes. Okay? So you have to play these kinds of tricks to avoid problems with respect to fragmentation and things like that. Yes, question.
Sorry, I'm just want to make sure I'm understanding the vocabulary. The bigger chunk you were just talking about would be a slab.
Yes, in this case, the bigger chunk would be a slab.
And
exactly.
So you said object cache could point to one or more slabs. That means you could have an object that was spanned across two slabs.
Yes. So what might happen is, so I didn't actually talk about the object cache at all here. Let's see if this works. So if you allocate that this is the first slab, which is, let's say, a page, you can have the second slab. And then if you have some space left over here and you can allocate an object, you can have this kind of stuff happen. Okay, so and then you can have a cache that basically points to where. That's mostly a metadata structure, which we don't have to worry about here. But that's really what it is saying. So you can have objects. Objects can be larger than slabs. Objects can span slabs. Objects can be smaller than a slab. Because you don't control what the size of an object is.
So,
yeah, just let me finish that. You have any follow-ups?
I was just going to say, so the object cache tells you where the object's stored, and the kernel stores the object cache itself. Somewhere
in the kernel, yes, exactly. So it's a metadata for where your allocated pages dynamically, yes.
Okay, so are these objects like part of like the heap? Like it's like object data from like a specific process?
Yes, so the kernel, think of it as kernel heap. This, we are talking about allocating memory for the kernel itself, not user processes. And the first takeaway is, the kernel has to manage its own memory. Nobody else is going to do it for the kernel. The second is you have to do it slightly differently. So this is how you would manage the kernel heap. Yes, although you may not even call it the heap for the kernel, but that's the way to think about it.
Okay.
Any other questions here? Okay. So with that, we will end the discussion on memory management. Okay, and we are going to switch to the next topic, which is going to be on storage and I/O system. Okay, so today we'll start with the file system, okay, and we'll grow this in layers. Okay, so we are done with this, just to see where we are. We did processes and threads and the hardware resource that we were concerned about, or CPU. We just finished this component, which is the address space of a process and the hardware resources memory. Now we are going to talk about the file abstraction and the file system abstraction. And then the hardware resource we will be concerned about is the disk. Okay, so that's where we are. So we will go in steps. So this is sort of the layers that you see in the kernel as far as I/O management is concerned. Okay, this is now only one type of I/O device, which is the disk. Okay, so in this topic, we'll first start with the disk as a particular representative I/O device. We will see how the OS manages disk as an I/O device. We'll see what kinds of abstractions are provided. This is the file system abstraction and so on. And then at a later point, we'll just look at I/O devices in general. Okay, what do device drivers do? Because you have to do the same stuff for any arbitrary I/O device. Right now, we are only going to look at one, which is the disk. And later on, we'll talk about other I/O devices. Okay. Now, as you can see, there is a set of layers in the kernel that depend on how you deal with the device. Okay, so at the very top are your application, and then there's a programmer interface. This is really the system call interface that user processes use to communicate with an I/O device. Okay, so in this case, we'll just the system call interface defaults to the files, so file level system calls, and we'll talk about them. Okay, what happens inside the kernel is once these calls come in, you have to translate them to disk level operations. Whether you're opening a file, closing a file, creating directories, deleting files, those translate to underlying disk level operation. Okay, so there's another layer that is actually going to translate whatever you're trying to do into I/O for the disk, which may be read some chunk to the disk, modify a chunk, write it back, whatever it is. By chunk, we mean disk blocks. Okay, so in today's class, we are going to look at this layer, okay, how the file system interface works. Next I will sort of go one level down and start looking at this thing, how do these operations translate to disk operations and file operations on disk and so on. Okay? So that's how we are going to proceed. Okay, so now for today we are not going to look at underlying aspects of the disk. So we'll just assume disk is a storage device. We'll not actually think about how is the physical disk going to work, how do you actually go retrieve data and so on. All that is hidden from us at the moment. We'll use just an abstraction of a storage device in this case. Okay? So let's start with thinking about data that you store on any storage device. Okay? So there are certain requirements, or in this case there are some assumptions that you as a user have made or are led to believe is going to happen with your data. First one is persistence. Okay? What this says is if you put some data on your storage device, you expect it to be there across power reboots. Okay? The memory contents are volatile. So the assumption is disk is a non-volatile medium. It's a persistent medium. Any data you write to disk is going to stay there. Okay? You can shut down your machine, come back to it a week later, your data hasn't gone away. Okay, so data stays around between jobs and power cycles and so on. Okay. Another assumption is speed. A general assumption is that if your OS is well written and the file system is well written, you can get to your data quickly. Your system is responsive. If you try to read a file, it reads it fairly in a reasonable time frame. Okay, what is quick, we will just leave that as a relative term for now. Okay. Size is the third extra assumption. So you have assumed that your disks are large, so you can store large amounts of data. Typically now you would get a 1 terabyte disk for a PC for less than $100. Okay, that's barely few pennies a gigabyte. Okay, that's a very low cost for storing data. Okay, so the assumption is, and then you basically create gigabytes and gigabytes of data and not actually have to worry about running out of storage space on a typical PC because now you have terabytes of data available. Okay, so store lots of data, sharing and protection. If you want to share your data with some other users who's accessing the same system, you can. The file system will allow you ways to either share data or explicitly not share data. If you feel some data is private, then you can make that private as well. Okay. And last but not least, ease of use. Yeah, this is an important point. The abstraction that the OS is providing to you hides lots of the underlying details. Okay. If you create a file, you don't have to worry about where is it stored on disk, how is it laid out, how do you get to it. You just access that file using the name. Okay. So you can assign whatever name you like, so you can remember what name you gave to your file. Okay. And all this comes down to ease of use. And next time when we talk about the actual layout on disk, you will see that there are lots of underlying data structures and details. All of that is hidden from the user. The OS takes care of all of the details. Okay, so going back to the very first class, when I said the OS takes care of lots of these details for you, this is an important concept in storage systems. Okay. Now, these are the requirements. So, as far as the hardware is concerned, it meets the first three, and the OS has to actually deal with the other two. Okay, so if you take a typical magnetic disk or a solid state disk, okay, the hardware provides you persistence. So anything you put on it, the hardware guarantees stays there. It provides you speed because it allows you random access, unlike some early versions of storage that were sequential access. Most disks are random access devices. You can go to any location on the disk and read data. And that's what we mean by speed. Okay? And size. Okay? Disks keep getting bigger. I think so. This I missed a zero there. Typical disk these days on a PC can be at least the biggest ones are 2 terabytes. Okay? So that's what you can actually buy today. Okay? That's not 200 but 2000 gigabytes. As far as the OS is concerned, it has to also deal with some notion of persistence. And here the persistence basically says that if you have corruption on the file system, the OS will take care of repairing the file system for you and so on, so that your data doesn't get lost. Sharing and protection is provided to read, write, execute privileges. We'll look at that. Ease of use, there are a whole bunch of features that the OS provides you. Okay? It allows you to create file names, associate names to files. It allows you to group files into directories and have a directory and subdirectory structure, so you can keep related files together. It transparently maps files to the locations on disk. It even allows you to search. So even if you say I created this file, I don't remember its name, you can now actually search through your entire system. Most operating system will actually do that for you. Okay. So we'll go through this one at a time. Okay, we'll start with files first, and then look at some how protection and all these other features are enabled. Okay. So let's start with the definition of a file. You all know what a file is. As far as our course is concerned, a formal definition, it's a logical container of data. Okay, it's a logical unit of storage that is kept on some storage device. Okay. Typically, this is a more formal definition, which is a named collection of related information. Okay, so just a fancy way of saying it's a container of data that you have a name associated with it. Okay, the name is given by users. Okay. As we will see next class, internally these names don't mean anything to the file system or the OS. Internally files are actually numbered. Okay, so when you give it a name, there's a mapping that the OS performs that takes the file name and maps it to a unique number. Okay, so all files, each file has a unique number inside the file system. Yes, question.
It's stored as hex, but it still has a file extension on it.
I'm sorry, what
it seems like the number is actually stored in hex, but it has the file extension despite the fact that there's a name. So even at its base level, it still has like a human readable file extension.
So the file extension, so what I mean by numbers are something else. There are things called inodes, and inodes are numbers. So internally the OS is actually going to refer to files by their number. Okay, if you just want to, so extensions are different, and I didn't mean that this string is actually stored as an ID. That's not what I meant at all. I'll just, if you want to see what I meant, or what you can do is if you actually go and do ls minus i, okay, and on a directory, you will see the ID of a file. That's the unique number for the file. That has nothing to do with the name. Okay? That's just the internal ID that is associated with the file. Okay. So names are just for human convenience. Okay? So you decide what the name is so you can get back to your file at a later point. Okay? Couple of other points. First is, as far as the OS is concerned, it doesn't actually worry about what is inside a file. You can store whatever you want, whether it's binary data, whether it's text, whether it's something else, it doesn't matter. Okay, just a container of data, you can store whatever you want. But as far as the file system is concerned, there are two types of files, okay, structured or unstructured. Okay, and there are competing philosophies in file system design. Okay, Unix typically assumes that the file is basically a sequence of uninterpreted sequence of bytes. You typical Unix file systems actually don't worry about what is inside the file or the structure of a file. Okay. But there are other types of file systems where the file is actually structured. You will say that this file is a collection of records. Each record is X bytes in size. Okay. These types of file systems exist. And these file systems are designed to implement or to optimize for database storage on disks. So databases, as you know, have tables, and tables have records, and records are typically of fixed length. Okay, to efficiently implement databases, there were actually file systems that were designed just for that purpose, and they were structured. Yeah, they actually had each file was a collection of records. You couldn't arbitrarily put any bytes you want. You had to organize that files as records and so on. Okay. So files could be structured or unstructured. Today most general purpose file systems are unstructured. They just assume it's a container of data. The file system doesn't impose any structure. You can store whatever you want in the file. Okay. And then there are file attributes. Every file has a name, it has a type, location, and so on. Okay. Now this is another important point. Okay. There are many file systems that do not associate a type with a file. Okay. The file name is not interpreted. Okay. You could say this is file lecture2.powerpoint, and that .ppt is not interpreted by the file system. And there are other file systems that actually look at the extension of the file type and associate a meaning with it. And Unix file systems typically don't. If you take Windows and Mac, they do. Okay, so if you actually go to any file on Macs, for instance, let's just look at one. Okay, so let's just take this file, which is the recording. So you will see that the file system actually is associated to type with the file, and it even associates what application to use if I click on the file and open it. All this is actually stored in the file system. Okay, so it's storing not, you can just use the extension or you can actually have additional metadata that stores all sorts of information about the file. Yes, question.
So what you're saying is that that's actually stored in the file system on Mac, but I mean you could do the same thing on, I don't know about straight up Unix, but I know on Linux.
So in Linux what happens is if you actually run GNOME or KDE and you double click on something, it does open an application. But that information is actually not inside the file system. That is stored outside the file system by the Windows desktop interface, and it has associated extensions with applications. So it is just blindly looking at the extension and saying, if you have a file with this extension, you double click on it, use this application and open it. That's all it is doing. Okay? But that information is not inside the file system. In this case, this is actually going... It depends on what version of files, which file system you're talking about. Typically, you will see that there is information in the file itself, in the file metadata itself that keeps this, and sometimes it's kept outside. Okay? So if you don't have it in the file system, you know, and you want to do things like that, you have to keep it outside, but it has to be kept somewhere.
Okay.
So files could be typed or not typed. Okay? So typically if you are plain vanilla Unix file system, they're untyped. The files don't have type, and if you want to associate types, you have to do it outside the file system. Okay. So with that background, let's now look at some file operations and see how to go about implementing. Okay. So typical operations you will do on files are open a file, create a file, delete files, and so on. These are for system calls. Okay. If you remember when we talked about system calls, I said typically when you write programs, you don't write you don't write code at this level. Okay. You are going to use the Java library or C++ library. In C++ you may use file open and so on. Those translate to these underlying system calls. And then there are a bunch of others that these manipulate files, these other system calls manipulate the metadata on file. They can change the attributes and so on, and we'll talk about those as well. Okay, so let's start with some of these operations and just quickly look at how do you implement. If you are writing a file system, what would you do? How would you implement those system calls? Okay. So two data structures to keep in mind. Okay. First one is called an open file table. The other one is a per process file table. These are in-memory data structures. Okay. It's very important to keep in mind that next class I'm going to talk about file metadata. Those are on-disk data structures. Okay. Two completely different things. Okay. These are data structures that the kernel keeps in memory about what files are open and so on. There are other data structures the file system actually maintains on disk. Okay, so, and those never go away. If you reboot, they will still be on disk. These will actually get wiped out because they are in RAM. Okay. Open file table is basically a table that says what are all the files that are currently open by any process. Okay. Per process file table just does the same thing for each process. So these are all PCB entries in some sense. It says what is open, which files are open, and what file descriptors are associated with it, and so on. Okay. So let's start with the first system call, which is create. So if the way you call this is just say create and give the name of a file, and then the OS is supposed to go create that file. Okay. So the way these are the steps you perform. So you need to first check if there is sufficient disk space. If they're out of space, you give an error and can't create any file. You actually also have to check if you have a file entry, okay, which is inode, which we have not yet talked about. If you are out of inodes also, you will give an error. Okay, but for now we won't worry about it. Okay, so you create a file descriptor for the file on disk. Okay. Then you have to add that file descriptor to the directory, okay, that this file is resident in. Because each file belongs to some directory. Okay, so once you create a file, you have to add it to the directory, so that's where how you are going to get to the file. Okay. Then if you have a particular type file system, you will associate some type with the file, okay, depending on what it is. Okay. And as I said, there are advantages and disadvantages. If you have types associated with files, the biggest advantage is your default operation. If you double click on an icon of that file, the OS knows what application to open, you know, so that's a convenience as far as users are concerned. Okay, the disadvantage is it makes the file system more complex. The file system needs to know about every possible type of file, what to do when the user tries to open that file. And this mapping has to be maintained in the file system or actually has to be associated with every single file. Okay. And as I already mentioned, Unix opts for simplicity. The file system is untyped. Macs and Windows actually have typed associated with it. And as was also pointed out, since Linux is a variant of Unix, the underlying file system is not typed, but then the types are maintained outside the file system, typically by the windowing interface. Okay, so create is very simple, and so is delete. Okay, when you delete a file, you just delete the entry from the directory, you delete the blocks of the file, okay, you just free them up by delete. We don't actually do anything to the blocks, we just go and put them on a free block list. Okay, these blocks are available for allocation. Okay, and you remove the descriptor from the directory. Now, what this should tell you is that there is some similarity between allocating pages to a process and allocating blocks to a file. Okay? In both cases, you are managing some space. Okay? In one case, you are managing memory. In another case, you are managing disk blocks. Okay? And we'll talk about doing contiguous allocation and non-contiguous allocation of disks next time. The same kinds of issues will crop up again. Yes, but this should sort of tell you that what the directory is, it's almost like a data structure that holds the index. The index is like a page table, as we will see next time. Okay. So create and delete are very straightforward operation. Now let's look at open, close, read and write, where you have to do a little more work. Okay. So suppose there is a file on disk, you try to open it. Okay. So open system call has actually two key arguments, some others, but two key ones, which is the name of the file that you are trying to open and the mode you are trying to open it. Okay. You can open a file in read mode, write mode or read write mode. Okay. Sometimes it's append mode as well. Okay. So if you want to open the file, first you have to check, is this file already open? Okay, some other process has opened it, in which case there is not much to do. Okay, so you basically already have an entry in your global file descriptor table. You are just going to use that entry and make it available to this process. Okay. So if it's already open, copy the file descriptor from the system-wide table to the per process table, you are done. Okay. So you also have to check for the protection bits on that file. If a process is trying to open a file, you have to check, is the process allowed to do it? If the process is not allowed to do it, then you have to give an error. If you are trying to open a file in write mode, but you cannot write to the file, then you will have to give an error. Okay? You will increment the open count, and I will talk about why you need that. Okay? And then you basically initialize the file. You are going to create an entry in the per process table and initialize the file pointer to the zeroth byte of the file. Yeah, because that's where you start reading. Okay. So, what this is showing you is this is basically a pseudocode that shows implementation of the open system call in the file system. Okay. Every file system that you have support for has to implement these operations. Okay. Today I won't talk about what is called the virtual file system switch. The way typically the open call works is the system call comes in. Okay. The kernel actually looks at where is the file actually stored, which device is it stored on. And depending on what file system is on that device, it is going to call the right file system code. Typical kernels may support more than one file system. Okay. Simple example is you will have always support for the FAT file system if you have a USB key or some such thing, and you may have NTFS or Mac has HFS, and or you may have EXT3 or EXT4 on Linux. So if you take any OS kernel, it may actually have support for easily half a dozen to a dozen different file systems. Every file system has to implement its own version of open, because only that file system understands how the data is stored and so on. The question here, yes.
I think this is probably a question for a day from now, but RAID,
yes.
I'm assuming, falls under the same category where it's just one layer below that.
Yes. So we'll come to RAID. RAID is how the storage is organized across multiple disks. We will talk about it two classes from now. Okay. And so that is even below the file system. That is how your storage is organized on hardware. Okay. So this is the interface. Then you have the file system and then your devices underneath. Any other questions here? Okay. So this is the implementation of the open. Okay. Close is very simple. You are going to remove the entry from the per process type file table. You are going to decrement the count. the count goes to zero, it says that no other process, ref count goes to zero, it says no other process has the file open, so you delete it from the system-wide file table, and you are done. Okay? So you might ask a question, why do you need this two data structures? You have a file table for the entire system and you have a per process file table. Okay? You would ask a question, why do we need, is it redundant? Are they duplicating information? What do you need it for? Okay, so the first data structure holds a global list of all files that are opened for reading or writing by any process in the system. The second data structure stores information about what this process is actually doing, which files does it have open. Okay, why do you need both? Why not just have one?
Well, for protection for one, right? I mean, you wouldn't want processes to be able to alter data in a file if they don't have permission to alter.
Fine. So you can do better protection. So let me ask the question some other way. Why do you need this? Why not just have that? Right? So one data structure for one entry per file, regardless of which process is accessing it. Yes, you have something to say.
I think there might be separate processes that's opening the same file to be able to modify their own section.
Yes.
That doesn't get affected back and forth.
Okay. You have something to say? Something else to say? Yes.
Well, a lot of the information that's stored in the per process file table, the current offset, the mode in which the process accesses the file, any pointers to its file buffer are going to be separate per process. So if two processes have the same file open and one of them reads the file, its current offset is going to move. But you don't want to move the current offset of the other process that has the file open. It doesn't want to wake up and all of a sudden find that its offset's in a different position.
Right.
So you have to store all that.
So what is being pointed out is that there is process state as far as each file is concerned. This is what this process is doing with respect to that file. So process B may open this file and it will be reading the file at this location. Process A may open the file and it may be reading the file at this location. Okay? That is per process information. The file is common across the processes, but they are actually reading or writing different portions of the file. And that particular state is captured in the per process file table. So there's a current position in the file. That's the per process thing. There's a mode in which a process is being is accessing the file. This process may have opened the file in write mode. Okay? This one may have just done in read mode. So you have to keep all this information somewhere and that is stored in the per process file table. Now why do you need the global file table? Because it has, as you can see, some information about the file itself that is common. Who is the owner of the file and so on and so forth. Okay? This is something you read from the disk. It's in the file system. You read that copy and brought it in. That's common. So if some other process tries to open the file, you don't have to go to read to disk to reread that metadata. There's a copy already in disk. You can check who is the owner, what are the ownership permissions, and so on. You can check that from this global file table. Okay? And so that is going to be common independent of what the process is doing. The owner of the file will not be different depending on the process. It's always going to be the same. So you need to keep these two data structures for different reasons. One shows common information about the file that you can use when you start doing operations. The other one stores per process state that is specific to the file. Okay, so that is the reason to have this system-wide table and then you have a per process table. So there are different things maintained in those data structures. They are not redundant. Okay. So read and write are also fairly straightforward. Yes, once you open the file, you can start reading or writing. Yeah, so typically when you say read, you give the file descriptor, you say this is the offset I want to read, this is the amount of data I want to read, and you give a buffer. Okay, so you might have a read call that looks like this. Just say offset is sizes. Okay. So you say read, this is the file descriptor. That's so once you open a file, okay, open is going to actually return to your file descriptor. Okay, so what it comes back from open is a file descriptor. When you open a file, you specify the name, you get a descriptor. From that point on, you use a file descriptor to access that file. Okay, you don't specify the name. So here you are just going to give the descriptor, say that this is the offset. So take position 10024 and then read 10 bytes from it and read it into this buffer. Okay, that buffer better be at least 10 bytes in size. Okay. What the read call is going to do is actually going to go into the file, read that chunk of data from the disk, okay, and then it is going to copy that data from that file chunk into the buffer. Okay. And as we will see next time, okay, I/O operations to disks are actually going to be in granularity of disk blocks. Okay, so we will see, just as you had memory pages, you are going to have something called disk blocks. You can only read or write in multiples of disk blocks. Okay. But as far as the read system call is concerned, you can read arbitrary chunks. You can read 1 byte, you can read 10,000 bytes, independent of what the size of the disk block is. The OS has to deal with all the hard work. Yeah, let's take the case where you are actually reading only 1 byte from the beginning of the file. Okay, so it says 0, 1 and the buffer. Okay, so you issue a read call, say read 1 byte from the beginning of this file. Okay, what the OS will do is it will get this request, it will go read the first block of the file. It cannot actually read 1 byte from disk. Okay, the disk won't allow it. Because the file system is going to only allow you to read in chunks of a block. Okay, typical block size is 4K. Okay. So the OS is actually going to read an entire block, 4 kilobytes. Even though the user requested 1 byte, it is going to store this into something called the buffer cache. From that cache, it is going to take the first byte of this block and then stick it into this user-specified buffer and give it back. Okay, so, is that clear? What I just said. Yes.
Is it different from a sector disk?
Disk block and sectors are slightly different things. Sectors are a hardware abstraction. A disk block is a software abstraction. The block size can be a sector, but typically block sizes are some multiples of sectors, as we will see. Okay, so this is the disk, the OS. Okay, so this says read 1 byte. So what happens if you send in a read request for 1 byte, you go and actually read 1 block, which is much bigger than a byte. You put it into a memory buffer. Okay, you extract the byte from that memory buffer and then you copy it into buff, which is specified there, and you return back to a user. Okay. All of that is hidden from you. You don't know that the OS actually read more data than you asked for, and the rest of it was actually stored in cached in memory. None of that is visible to you. Okay? All that is done by the file system. Yes,
is
question.
Is that memory buffer actually in physical memory, or is that in...
Is that in physical memory?
Physical memory of the OS.
This is going to be, buffer cache is going to be in the physical memory of the OS. This is part of the memory that last time when I was showing virtual memory, you saw some pages were wired. They are not paged out. Okay. Buffer cache is memory that you don't want to page out. You just read this block from disk. If you swap it out back to disk, the whole point is lost. You are keeping it there so that if subsequent read come, I can actually take that data that I already read and return it. Okay. So some of these things are going to be hardwired. You are not going to page it out. Okay. So that's random. So that's the read call for random access. You can specify an offset and read from any location on disk. You can also do sequential access where you just see where the file pointer is and read the next chunk of data. Very similar, you just don't specify the offset. You see where the file pointer points to and then read this many bytes and stick it into this buffer. Okay. So this is, remember, this is pseudocode. This is not that the file is actually an array. This thing is actually an I/O instruction that goes to the hardware device where it get back a chunk of data and then you copy it. So the pseudocode here is hiding lots of things, what's actually going on inside the OS. Okay, so write is very similar. I'm not going to worry about it. Or neither am I going to worry about memory mapping. We did that earlier. Okay. There's also a seek call, which basically just allows you to change the file pointer to wherever you want. Okay. So typically what most OSs will do is they will not actually have a direct, they'll only have a sequential read call. They may not have a random access call, but they will support seek. So if you want to do random access, first you move the file pointer and then you read sequentially from that location. And if you want to read from another location, you do another seek. Okay, so you can use seek and sequential access to emulate random access. Yeah, that's something to keep in mind. Okay, so a couple of interesting side points here. So what kinds of accesses do you typically see as far as user programs are concerned, as far as OSs are concerned? Okay. So typically from a programmer's perspective, I/O is either going to be sequential or it's going to be what is called keyed or hashed. Okay. Sequential I/O you already know. You're just reading a whole file sequentially. Very common. Okay. You open a file in an editor. Okay. The OS goes, reads the entire file into the editor's memory and then the editor displays the entire file to you. Okay, the compiler compiles an entire file. You read the whole file sequentially, you compile it, write out a binary object which is also written out sequentially. Okay. So sequential accesses are fairly common. Many applications just read entire files or read them sequentially in some smaller chunks. Okay. But there are many other applications where you are going to actually use keyed access. Okay? Databases are the best examples of this. Okay? In databases, you are basically going to try to read a record from some location in a table, which is also stored on disk. Okay? Those are not sequential calls. Okay? You are going to go and basically, typically the call is going to be based on, think of it as a key value pair. Okay? You specify a key and you get a value out. So database accesses look like this. Database search, if you store a hash table on disk, it's also going to look like this. If you have very large data structures that are hash tables that are made persistent, then you are going to get similar kinds of accesses. Dictionary search is going to be similar. Okay, if you actually write a search engine, okay, then it is going to also do lookups that look like this. The key is going to be your search term, the value is going to be all the matches for the search term. Okay. So that's another common kind of access. So typically as per user programs are concerned, we'll have either sequential access or keyed access. Now as far as the OS is concerned, sequential access at the user level is sequential access at the system level, at the disk level. Keyed access at the user level becomes random access at the disk level. Okay? Any keyed access essentially is random access. Okay? The reason this is important to understand is that there are sequential and random accesses is next time when we talk about file systems, we will actually go back and understand how the file system performs when you have sequential and random access. Okay, and we'll see certain kinds of file systems are very good for sequential access, but very bad for random access. And others try to balance both. Okay? So just to give you an example, if you look at FAT file systems, you will see that they're better off for sequential access, not so great for random access, and other kinds of file system will do both. Okay, so how to design your file system for these access patterns is something we'll look at next time. But right now, we just keep in mind that you can both do sequential and random. Okay. So the next concept is directories. Okay, this also you know, so I'm going to go through this quickly. Okay, so directory is just a collection of files. Okay. So users decide what the directory name is, what is stored in a directory, and so on. The file system doesn't impose any restrictions. And typically what you have in most file systems today is what are called multi-level directories. Okay, back in the old days, that was not the case. There are file systems that did not support directories. All the files had to be stored in the root directory. Or there are just two-level directories, okay, which meant that every directory name had to be unique. Okay, clearly, those restrictions were too restrictive. So now you have a multi-level directory. You know, let me draw a picture to show you how a directory structure looks, what it looks like. Okay, if you take a typical Linux or a Unix file system, you will have a special directory at the very top called the root directory. Okay, this root directory will have some subdirectories saying user, bin, home, and so on. Each of this might have other subdirectories. So you might have something called local here, bin, and so on. And there may be files. Okay, so you might have something Firefox, you might have ls, and so on. Okay. So the way to think about a directory is it's a tree-like structure as far as the OS is concerned. Okay. Any interior node in the tree is a directory or a subdirectory. The leaves of the tree are always going to be files. Okay, because you can't have any structure below a file. Okay, so typically what you get at the very bottom is either an empty directory. Okay, that's the only case where you have a leaf that is going to be a directory, is an empty directory. But typically there's a file in that directory, then you basically have a file, end file, that becomes a leaf. So keep this in mind. We'll talk about why this tree structure is important in just a minute. Okay, so as far as users are concerned, you can navigate this tree using a variety of techniques, and we'll talk about a couple in just a moment. But the thing to keep in mind is that this is a tree. And you'll see what happens when you let some operations, if you allow some operation, this no longer remains a tree, and that is going to create some problems, and we'll look at that in just a minute. Okay, so one point I want to make is when you open a file, okay, your file system has to do a lot of work of navigating through this tree. Okay, so if you say open, let's say, I'm just going to make so if I just say read foo, yes.
Do you have a notion of path at that point?
Yes. So I'm just going to come to, that's what I'm trying to explain here. So if you just issue a call saying read this file foo, what does the OS have to do? Okay. First thing it has to do is so this is called a relative name. Okay. Typically you can have two types of names for a file, an absolute name and a relative name. The absolute name for this file is, okay, this is the full name of the file. Okay, it says home shenai foo. That's basically the entire path name to get to that file. Okay. So you either specify this full name or you specify a relative name. Okay. If you specify a relative name, what the OS is going to do is it's going to interpret that name with respect to what is called a current working directory for that process. Okay. Every process has something called a current working directory, CWD. Okay. So all file names are interpreted with respect to that current working directory. So if you are trying to access this file here, the current working directory for the process that issued it better be /home/shenoy, because this file is actually in there. Okay. So what that means is when you issue this call, it is going to prepend this prefix to the file, whatever the current working directory. CWD is home shenoy. It is going to take this string and attach it to that string and think that's the file I need to worry about. Okay. Once you get the file name, you are going to actually recursively descend down this tree to look for that file. You are going to start with slash. This is called dereferencing dereferencing the file. So you start with slash and say, is there a directory called home in there? Okay, you say yes, then you go into that directory and say, is there a subdirectory called shenoy in there? You look in there and say, you say yes. Then you say, is there a file called foo in that directory? And then you say yes, and then you actually go and read the file descriptor or the file metadata from the disk. Okay. So opening a file may involve several disk operations, okay, up to depending on how deeply nested this file is. Okay. Several disks, and we'll talk about how to make that efficient next time. Okay. Not today, but all you need to keep in mind is the directory structure is hierarchical. It's a tree, and then typically that tree structure is used by the file system to navigate and try to get to files that the users have accessed. Okay, so now we'll worry about why this tree is important when we talk about referential naming. Okay, so you may have heard about hard links, soft links, sim links, shortcuts, these terms. So this is what all of this means. So a typical file has a unique name associated with it. But most file systems allow you to associate multiple names to the same file. Okay, and this is done through what is called referential naming. Okay. There are two kinds of referential naming techniques. One is called hard link, the other one is called soft link. Okay. A hard link is essentially, think of it as giving two names to the same file. Okay. So you have a file, as I said, internally the files are numbered. So let's take file number 100. Okay. Its name is A. Okay. If you actually do hard links, you can give a second name to that file and you give it name B. Now, regardless of whether you access the file as A or B, you are getting to the same file. Okay, so you are now given two names to that file. You can give as many names as you want. Okay, and I'll show you how to do that. Okay. Now, so these are two names to exactly the same file. Okay. So what that does is every time you associate a name, it is going to increment what's called the ref count of the file, which says how many names does this file have. And as you start deleting the file, it will decrement each of those names. It's going to decrement, and when it goes to zero, the file is going to be deleted, and I'll show you that as well. Okay. Now, as far as most operating systems are concerned, they will not impose some restrictions on how you create hard links. In particular, they will not allow you to create hard links to directories. The reason they don't allow you to create hard links to directories is if you allowed hard links to directories, you are going to break the tree structure. Okay? The tree will either become a DAG, a directed acyclic graph, or worse, the tree will actually have cycles. Okay? So in particular, here is an example where you see a tree, what was a tree, but you created some weird hard links and introduced a cycle. So what you may do is, if let's say bin is a directory, you will actually, if you go and try to create a bin and make it a hard link like this, okay, say create a subdirectory called bin in local, but that is a hard link to this parent directory called user, now you have a cycle in the graph. Okay, this is no longer a tree, it has a cycle, and cycles are going to be bad. Okay, so if you have a backup program running, it's going to go into an infinite loop, because it will come here, it will try to back up this directory, which will send it back there, and it will just sit and recurse. Trying to do recursive descent, you will also go into an infinite loop. Okay. So typically, this is not allowed, okay, because it's going to break our tree structure. Okay. You can create hard links to files, but not hard links to directories. Okay, so, and I'll show you examples in just a second. Okay. The other kind of referential names are soft links. Well, these are also called shortcuts or symlinks, if you heard of any of these terms. So this is basically, think of it as not two, it is essentially boils down to two names for the file, but it's effectively a pointer to a file. Okay, so if you had the same file 100 and it had a name A, then you basically, if you want to create a soft link, you say whenever I try to open file B, go and look up file A. Okay, so in file B, you are not actually going to point to the file, you are just going to add a shortcut saying, so it's like a forwarding address, saying if you want to access B, go and actually look at A. Okay? That's called a soft link. Okay? Soft links are allowed in directories. Okay? Although hard links are not. And this is because if you have a soft link, you have most backup programs, they'll just ignore the soft link. They won't actually traverse it. Hard links you can't distinguish. You're forced to traverse. Okay? So if you want to have two names for the same directory, the only way to do it is using a shortcut or a soft link. Okay? Otherwise, it doesn't work. So let me show you some examples. Okay, so what we'll do is I'm going to make it a little bigger. The projector is messed up. Okay, so first we'll make a file. We'll call it foo. Okay, we're going to say there's already a file. Let me remove that. We'll restart. Okay, first we make a file. We write something to the file. Yeah, okay. It's not cat. I need to echo in there. Okay. Cat here. Okay, so there's a file called foo. Okay, so if I want to now make a hard link, I'm going to say and bar. Okay. So now if I try to actually read bar, you will get the same thing. In fact, you can verify that these two are the same files, because you will see that they are the same ID. Okay. So if foo and bar actually are the same numbered file, which is a unique file. So these are two names for the same file. Okay. So in fact, now if I actually go and remove the original file foo, okay, you will see that bar is still there. Okay? Because it just removed a name, it's not removed the file itself. The ref count has actually gone from 2 to 1. Okay, it knows that there's another name for this file, so it's not going to delete the contents of the file.
So yes, when you remove bar, then does it delete the contents?
Yeah, so I'll show you that. So that the file is still there, so if you now remove bar, file is gone. Okay? So that's just hard link. So now I'll just show you if instead of, so now this foo is a directory, but not a file. And if you now try to do a hard link to a directory, it will give an error saying I cannot do it because it's a directory. Okay? So let me remove that directory. So now we will make another, recreate the old file. Okay, so now we have another file called foo, but this time we will make a soft link. Okay, so we will see that there are now two files, right? And if you actually look at the file IDs, you will see that there are two different files. Okay, there are two different numbers. So this is 222, that's 140. Okay. When you had a hard link, they were actually the same files. In this case, bar is simply a pointer. Okay, as you can see here, if you try to open bar, the file system will be told, go and look at that file and open that file instead. Okay. So as far as most operations goes, it will do exactly the same thing. If you try to read bar, you will actually go read foo and you will get the same end effect. Okay. But now what happens is if you actually go and remove foo, which you can, okay, bar is still here. Okay, bar isn't gone, but if you try to now read bar, you will get an error. Okay. This is a dangling pointer, because all that bar is says is, if you want to open this file, go read that file instead. The file system is not tracking whether this file exists or not. This is simply a forwarding address. Right? So you want to read this, go read that. So if you delete the original file, the forwarding address is still there. Okay, when you try to read it and you go to read foo, yes, basically you have a dangling pointer. Okay, so you get this when you have shortcuts, but you delete the original file, you will have the same issue. Yes,
so in
question.
Case if you make a new foo, it will again point to it.
Yes, because it could be now a different foo, but this is a forwarding address, right? So it's just going to can actually do that. Okay, we can now. Because it doesn't know what is happening to the original file. Yeah, so you can delete it, you can recreate it with a new file, and you still get dereferenced. Yes.
There's still an implicit PWD in front of that foo, though, right? Like there's still the current working directory in front of that foo. Like
yes.
But you can explicitly pass from the root if you want.
That. So if you want, you can actually do things like, you can now make some directories here. First of all, symlinks don't have to be within files of the same directory. You can make symlinks to wherever you want. Right, so, also I'll show you, now if you have foo as a directory, you can actually make a symlink to it. Because this is simply a forwarding address. So in this case, all it says is if you want to open this, go open that. And when the file system comes and opens, it says that's a directory. So it goes and opens that directory. Okay, yes.
When you create a link, will it store the full path? So like if I move the link, it'll still be pointing to the right spot, it won't.
If you move the link, we can try that. We can move bar into foo. Well, we didn't. Yes, bar. So it is basically just storing the same thing. It is not storing the full address there. In this case, I just said foo, so it just stored foo. If I said make a symlink of full name, it would have stored that as well. Right, so
if you move, if I make a symlink to something and then I move the symlink, it loses track of what it was linked to?
Yes. Because it is not internal, it hasn't stored the whole thing here. If you had created a symlink with a full name, that would be different.
Okay.
Okay, so that is referential naming. So there are some subtleties here with respect to hard links and soft links. As I said, when you create hard links, there are two names for the exact same file. Okay, so both names actually refer to the same file. This is just a way of giving multiple names to a file. And soft links basically is more of a pointer. to a file. It's not actually pointing to the file. It just says go look up that file, and then you actually have to go and look up the original file. Okay. So directory operations I already talked about. We'll talk quickly about protection, and then again I'll show you some stuff. So protection information in the file system allows you to figure out who is allowed access to a file. Okay. There are two types of two ways to do it, or two types of data structures you can use to do it. Okay. What Windows NT has is what is called access control list, or ACLs. Okay. So it's basically ACLs. Okay. And so what you do for each file is you say this is the user and these are the things that this user can do on the file. Every file has a list associated with it. The list of all the users that can do any operation on that file, and all the operations that that user can do on that file. Okay. So if you had a file who in Windows, you can have an ACL which says Shenoy can rewrite this file, some other user 2 can only read this file, user 1 can write to this file. You can have a list of arbitrary size. This is called the access control list for the file. So when a process actually tries to open this file, you are going to check the owner of that process and compare it against the ACL and see is the owner actually in the access control list. If not, you have no access to that file. And if you do have that access, do you have the right permissions to do whatever operation you are trying to do? Okay. So ACLs can be of arbitrary size. ACLs can be nested rather than users. You can just have user groups and so on. Yes, sir. Yes, question.
I find it to be kind of disingenuous to say that it's large and easy to maintain, because you can do groups in the ACL.
That's what I just said. You can actually have groups,
okay,
but they can be of arbitrary size. Right? There is no restriction. That is just a administrative convenience saying, rather than the administrator going and saying, I will allow these 500 users access to the file, the administrator has created a group consisting of that 500 users and put one entry. That's different from saying that the ACL actually limits the number of entries in the access control list. The access control list can be of arbitrary size. Is that clear what I just said?
Yeah.
So groups are just an administrative convenience that allows you to specify an operation on a group of users rather than having to name them individually. The OS or the file system is not going to limit how many entries there are. All I was saying is there is going to be arbitrary entries allowed in this ACL. You can add as many groups as you want, you can have as many users, and you can get the same effect by having a group of 500 users or an ACL with 500 entries. Yes, you had a question. Okay. All right. So lists can be large, yeah, because the OS is not going to prevent any or have any restrictions on it. Okay. Now, what Unix does, or old versions of Unix, not anymore, what they did is they basically approximated this. Rather than saying I'm going to have a list of arbitrary size, they said all users in all users in the system have three categories. Okay, so we basically, rather than saying that, let me say each file has an owner and a group, and operations on these files are specified based on what the owner can do, what the group can do, and what everyone else can do. Okay, so this is a coarse grain approximation of an ACL with three entries. Okay, this is always an ACL with a fixed size with three entries, and what is the user allowed to do, what is the group that this file belongs is allowed to do, and what is everyone else. And each of these three groups of entities can either read, write, or execute on this file. Okay, so you can set a read, write, execute bit for the owner, read, write, execute for the group, read, write, execute group for the world. Okay. So this basically allows you to have a fixed size access control list, but it is an approximation. Okay, so if you want two users to do something, the only way to do that is to actually make one user the owner and create a group for that user and specify that. Or if the group has more than that many users and you specify it, you are inadvertently letting other users do something that you may not have intended to do. Okay. So either then you have to create a specific group just to allow those operations, or you have to do it some other way, okay, which is just allowing more users access to a file than not. Now, most recent versions of Unix operating system, so Unix file system still do this, but they have started supporting ACLs as well, as I'll show you in just a moment. Okay, so this is basically, if you actually do ls minus l, you will see that that's the permission bits on a file. Okay, so here I, the owner, have the read, write, execute permission. No one else has any permission. Neither the group nor world has any permission. You can of course change that. Okay, you can just let me just remove this bar and just touch. So if you say change mod group plus read write bar, so now you have just added read write bits to the group, and you can do that same thing to the user and so on. Okay. Now as far as access control lists are concerned, if you have ext3 or ext4 file systems, they support both. They support read write permission bits. So if you now, let's see, so this, that you can only do on a Unix machine, so I have to log in. Okay, so that's created a file foo, and it has read, write, execute bit. So if you actually have ext3, if you say get file acl foo, you will see that there is a file list associated with it. By default, the acl is the same as the read, write, execute permission bits, which says the user can do this, group can do this, use other can do this. But then you can actually do something called set file access control list, which I don't know the syntax for. So you can say minus m and then say something, set file suppose you have to say something about users here. Oh, I don't like it. Okay, so I have to actually do a man on this and figure this out. But
I think you just hit the user right there. If you were to dash m user,
let's do something. User.
It's going to be barf. It doesn't have the right username.
Okay. Plus read. That work. It wants more entries. So I have to figure out what the exact syntax for this is, but the point I'm trying to make is this: file access lists are no longer in, even in Unix Unix operating systems, or rather Linux operating systems. You have a file access control list associated with it. Okay, so this can be of arbitrary size, and the reason that is important is when you design your file system, when you associate metadata with the file system, if your file access control list is of arbitrary size, that metadata is also going to be of arbitrary size. Okay? If you just had the read, write, execute permission bits, then you know that you have to store 9 bits for per file permissions. And that's always fixed. That's coarse grain but fixed. And then the metadata will also be a fixed size. You will have user size of the file and then permission bits on the file and so on. Okay? So when we talk about allocating data structures for the file system, this is going to come back and say what happens if the metadata is of arbitrary size. We'll see that there are implications of that on file system design. Makes the design more complicated. If the metadata is now of arbitrary size, there are allocation problems with it. Okay? So that's protection. So basically we went through the file system API, which says what are the file operations, what can you do, what is referential naming, and how protection information is actually included in the file. Okay. Next time we will actually now go to the next layer, which is the underlying storage layer, and see how the file system is actually managing space on this. So all of that is going to be hidden from the user, but the OS has to actually deal with it at the file system level. Okay. So we will stop here today and then continue this next time.
Thank you.